Good afternoon, everybody. Very good to see you all here today. Is everyone settled at the top there? More or less. As you can see from this style of dress, I'm no longer the director of the LSE. In other words, I've got a sabbatical term this term. So I have 3 months off to do some reading and writing. And it is a very great thing, so please don't blame me for any problems that happen in the LSE this term. And you can see how dedicated I am that I actually come to give these lectures when I don't have to. So I'll be giving this lecture today, on the theme of which is inequality and how to combat it in inequality. And the last lecture next week is about Third Way, Third World, that is a look at the political debate which is going on in relation to developing countries as concerns the issues that I raised in the last three lectures last term and the ones that I'll talk about today. But today I'll be talking primarily about inequality in the industrial countries. I'll be talking about global inequalities next time. First of all, though, there's a lot of people still wandering in up there. First of all, I'd like to try this joke out on you. I told this joke at a meeting of German sociologists and not a single person laughed. And I have to find out if that's because it was Germany or it was because it's not a very graspable joke. This actually is a Russian joke. There's a new Russian, right? You know what new Russians are. New Russians are rich, the new rich bourgeoisie in Russia. A small minority of the population, majority of the population live in considerable poverty these days in Russia. Every day this guy goes out of his house in his big new Land Rover, which they all drive there. And every day this traffic cop comes up to him and finds him $10, either because his antenna is too high or because his wheels are dirty or just because he feels like him. And then for 2 weeks, he doesn't see the guy with the Land Rover. He seems to have disappeared. And then he comes back and the traffic cop says, "Where you been?" And the new Russian says, "I've been on my holidays in the Bahamas." And the traffic cop says, "What? On holiday? On my money?" You more or less get it, then. What I take it, this joke or non-joke shows, or one of the things it might be said to show, is that every society presumes a conception of social justice, and every society presumes some kind of mechanism of economic redistribution, and when that redistribution doesn't occur through legitimate means, it will sometimes occur through illegitimate ones. So social justice, redistribution, inequality, these are the themes of this lecture. Since I've had no time to think about this lecture, I'll just try and write out a format for what I'll talk about. First of all, I'd like to say a few things about the nature of inequality and why inequality matters in politics, as indeed it does matter. First of all, inequality, I think for reasons which can be fairly easily specified, is crucial to the left, to the political left. And indeed is one of the main things that separates left from right still in contemporary political theory and practice. Second, the left has a particular conception of inequality. Different, I think, from many liberal and more right-wing thinkers, as it were, a richer notion of what equality and inequality mean. And third, you have to at least recognize a distinction between equality of opportunity and what philosophers, political theorists normally call equality of outcome. I don't know if you can read this writing, it's a rather thick pen. Under category one, I'll have to go through these things fairly quickly. This lecture would be completely unsatisfying for anyone who wants detail, because all the issues raised really could be pursued in a lot more detail than I've got time to do here. Second, there are three aspects of what inequality is in contemporary societies which we need to look at. First, the extent of inequality in the industrial countries. Second, patterns of inequality. And as we'll see, these have been changing quite substantially over the past 30 or so years. One reason why you need third way type policy, or you need a modernizing political policy to cope with them, because the sort of structure of inequality in industrial societies has changed very substantially along with changes in the class structure. Some of those aspects of those changes, especially the shrinkage of blue-collar manufacturing work, I've talked about in previous lectures. Third, we have to look at least briefly about the causes of increasing inequality, where indeed it is increasing. Third, I want to look within the amount of time that I have at what policies can be used to counter inequality in contemporary societies. Basically, I think one has to argue, at least if you stand left of center, that you cannot have a good society which is scarred by too deep inequalities, however you might define the too deep in that loaded observation. Therefore, any worthwhile left of center party must have a program which seeks to increase equality within a given society. And I think if you look at the kind of reforms of political policy these days, there are lots of different strategies around, but there are three or four key ones, really, which any effective left-to-center political party now has to use. One is simply the issue of taxation, redistribution through the fiscal system of economic income and wealth. Second, which all left-of-center governments are turning to more and more, is investment in human capital, especially linked to the idea that a core anti-poverty strategy in contemporary society has to be linked to work, that having a job, as long as you're protected with a decent minimum wage, is one of the most effective routes out of poverty for a high proportion of people, obviously not everybody, within a contemporary society. Third, you have to have targeted anti-poverty policies, for reasons I'll mention, to do with the changing structure of inequality. And fourth, crucial, really, we've come to see that there are trade-offs involved in the relationship between equality and economic prosperity. In a contemporary society, you have to find some kind of balance between pushing for greater equity but not damaging the overall prosperity of the economy, because that simply rebounds on any attempts to produce a more egalitarian society. Fourthly and finally, it's a longer list than I thought it might be, if I get around to it at the end, a lot of that is about inequality at the bottom, what you do about poverty, if you like, in a contemporary society. recognizing that in an industrial society, all poverty is inequality. Poverty and inequality are inextricable in an industrial country because you have virtually no absolute poverty in industrial countries. So when you're talking about poverty, you're talking about inequality, and most measures of poverty are explicitly measures of inequality. For example, the EU measure of poverty is someone is in poverty if they are earning less than half the median income of a given society. So all measures of poverty are in effect measures of inequality. But of course you have fundamental problem of inequality at the top. If you like, the fat cat problem, if you want to put it that way. What do you do about the elites? What do you do about the wealthy? What do you do about the powerful? Every left of centre government must have policies relevant to that area of inequality too. If I get around to it anyway, there are three aspects to that. There is again the issue of taxation. There's the issue of sustaining good public institutions and making sure that elites want to participate in those institutions. For example, in lots of countries, elites opt out of the state education system or the state health system, and they go into a kind of private ghetto. You don't want that to happen if you want to create a solidary society. You must have some policies relevant to that. And third, this raises a big issue about which I'll make a few comments if we get time. Regulation of corporate power. This looks like a decent structure for a lecture, so I'd better take this piece of paper away with me when I go, because it looks quite good. First of all, general notion of inequality and the three points that I mentioned there. Inequality and the attack on inequality is crucial to the left, and many people argue, and I would agree with them, that it is one of the defining features that still separates left from right. Left and right are still distinguished in contemporary politics, as I mentioned in an earlier lecture. There still are important axes of contemporary politics which separate left from right, and a concern with equality is certainly one of these. One of the best writers on this issue, if you're interested in pursuing it, is the Italian writer Norberto Bobbio. Bobbio, B-O-B-B-I-O, who wrote a book called Left and Right, which I think I probably put in the original book list. It's a bestseller in Italy, sold hundreds of thousands of copies in Italy, sold about 2,000 copies in this country, which might tell you something about the intellectual level of this country. Nevertheless, famous book in Europe, in which Bobbio argues that concern with equality is, in his view, the prime concern that separates left and right, is the continuing axis around which many other things are grouped. And you can make a strong case for this, as I said. A good society is one which does not allow inequality to escape certain bounds, and it's up to a thinker or political party to try to define what those bounds are. This connects with the second point, however, because the left has always, I think quite rightly, insisted on a substantive view of equality, not just a formal view of equality. A formal view of equality would simply be, as it were, a legal affirmation of equality, that we are all legally equal citizens in a contemporary society. The problem with that, as the left has always argued, is that formal equality and formal citizenship are not the same as substantive equality and substantive citizenship. There's a difference between a society in which everyone is free to live in Mayfair or to live in St. James's, or a society where people have substantive resources which allow them to have decent housing. A society where some people live in St. James's and Chelsea and others live under bridges or along the pavements and the Strand would not be a society which would meet the left's criteria of equality, even though the person asleep on his or her cardboard bed on the Strand will be formally equal as a citizen to the person living in the most affluent areas of London. You must therefore have a substantive notion of equality, and that again tends to separate left from right. It's always been the left that's primarily insisted on that, and I think this is correct. Third, you must also recognize there will always be two aspects of equality. Equality of opportunity means the capability of reaching whatever level in a society is commensurate with your capabilities, your drive, your motivation, your values, what you want out of life. But you can't have a society which would be purely oriented towards equality of opportunity. This is not just a sociological point, it is actually a logical point. It's quite wrong, as some people on the left have recently taken to arguing, that you should concern yourself only with equality of opportunity. The reason is that you must have a decent level of equality outcome, which is actual equality of people's incomes or wealth at any point in time, because otherwise equality of opportunity would be self-negating. Equality of opportunity brings people like Bill Gates to the fore, for example. I presume, although this could be debated, and we could have a very interesting debate about it, that you don't want a society where you could not have a Bill Gates. Bill Gates came from more or less nowhere, and now he's normally thought to be the richest man in the world, and his wealth equals the combined wealth of several nations. What you don't want, presumably, is Bill Gates is forming a kind of encrusted dominant class, because where that happens, you obviously would not have equality of opportunity for the next generation. Therefore, I think you can say strongly that equality of opportunity is always dependent on redistribution. You must have redistribution to have a socially just society, no matter how much emphasis you choose to put on equality of opportunity. Otherwise, equality of opportunity for one generation will become inequality of opportunity for the next generation. And there are all sorts of interesting structural issues around that. Let's take a look at what's been happening to inequality in the industrial countries over the post-war period, which is very interesting. Many people say that economic inequality, or perhaps inequality in general, has been increasing, has been growing in the industrial countries, and of course in the less developed countries too, over the past few decades. And if you look at the gross statistics of economic inequality, you can certainly see some justification for that. If you look at the period from 1950 to 1970, in industrial countries. In most industrial countries, economic inequality as measured by the usual criteria anyway, declined. That was a period when societies seemed to be becoming more egalitarian in terms of not just their income distribution, but to also to some extent distribution of wealth too. Over the period since then, from 1970 to 2001, where we've got to so far, this pattern seems to go into reverse. Many countries over that period have experienced increasing inequality. Now, those statements, baldly put, are true, but you have to recognize that things are more complicated, as they always are, than such general statements would suggest. First of all, if you just use orthodox economic measures, the usual measure of inequality is something called a Gini coefficient. Gini coefficient, which is economic measure of income dispersion. If you just look at that as the standard measure of inequality, it is not the case that inequality has grown in all the industrial countries over that period. There are some exceptions, no one knows quite why. For example, the statistics on Italy show that Italy has become a more equal society, as indicated by that measure over that period, whereas the majority of countries seem to have gone in the reverse direction. Second, if you take a broader definition of inequality, it's plain that, Western societies are not becoming simply more unequal. If you look at inequalities between the sexes, for example, although it's true that there is no country where women are economically equal to men, nevertheless, over this period, in virtually all industrial countries, women have become more equal, not just in terms of economic position, but also in terms of legal rights and other rights as well. This is also true of minority groups. It's true in many countries of subcultural groups. It's true of people like the disabled. It's true of sexual minorities and so on. In most countries, such groups have become more equal rather than less equal. What this tends to imply is that when you look at the issue of inequality, you're not just talking about a naked increase. You're talking more about changes in patterns of inequality. You're talking more about a changing form of inequality, not just a kind of absolute increasing levels of inequality, however you might measure that. The official statistics tend to show a kind of regular distribution of countries in terms of economic inequality, which is also quite interesting because it seems to correspond roughly to the structure of welfare states, in which those countries which are, by the usual measures again, the most unequal include the US, New Zealand, and Israel, although some people dispute that Israel should be in there. And then you have a group of countries with medium levels of economic inequality, and they include the UK, which is kind of on the high side, however, France, Germany, which is more on the low side, and then you have those societies which are most egalitarian, and they include especially the Nordic countries, but also Japan. One of the things this list shows you is that there isn't a straightforward correlation between the amount of public money spent on welfare systems and equality, because Japan spends only a low level of its GDP on welfare institutions, but still is one of the most egalitarian societies in the world by usual measures. There's also very interesting things happening here. These countries, at least until recently, I meant to include the UK in there, these countries are becoming more unequal, have done up until the year 2000 when the last measures apply. Most people think this is also true of the US, that the US is simply becoming more and more unequal, but this is false. Since 1995, again, for whatever reason, income inequality in the United States has gone into reverse. For something like 28 years, inequalities were growing in the United States, but over the past 5 years or so, this has gone the other way. The United States is actually becoming more egalitarian by the usual economic measures. The lowest income groups have done best over this period. Blacks and Hispanics have done especially well. No one can be sure why. Is it to do with the policies of the Clinton administration or not? Is it to do with a full employment economy so that these things will go back into their old pattern if there should be a fall off in the American economy? No one really knows for sure. But there is an interesting difference there, because countries like France, for example, which spend a lot more on welfare institutions than the United States do, seem to be experiencing growing poverty and growing inequality. Something dysfunctional has happened to the welfare state, at least within a range of European countries, EU countries, and given that I get time, I'll come back to that a bit later on. Patterns of inequality, this is really, I think, sort of crucial in lots of ways. And there are two things in particular that I want to say about it. First, for many years, and still to some extent today, people who haven't really tumbled to it, people looked at inequality in a frozen snapshot way. Most of the statistics that I've just been relying on for the first observations I made about inequality are snapshot statistics. They show you the income distribution or the wealth distribution at one point in time. But until recently, which is only about the last 10 years or so, we didn't actually know much about who the people were in these distributions and what happened to their career trajectories. There's very little research done on people moving in and out of poverty, people moving up and down the income scale. It's only fairly recently that such research has been available, and it has revealed an enormous amount. If you don't mind me mentioning some of the things involved in case they interest you, one of the best books on this is by two Germans called Liebling and Leibesfruit. This is not an anti-German lecture, I strongly... It's called Time and Poverty in Western Welfare States. I strongly recommend this book if you're interested in these issues. Also a researcher, famous one here, called John Hills, who is the head of the Social Exclusion Unit in the LSE, has been doing similar research here on career trajectories. What Liebling and Leibesfruit show is that their research is about Germany. What their research shows is there are far more poor people in Germany than we ever thought before. Over a 10-year period, they show perhaps as many as 40% of the population of Germany are poor, which is quite a counterintuitive finding, actually. But they also show nearly all of them also move out of poverty. A lot more people experience poverty or low income, but also there is an enormous amount of movement out in and out of poverty over a 10-year cycle period. Quite a high proportion of people who are poor never reappear as poor within that period. Unless you know the career trajectory of poverty, unless you know how many people move in and out of the lower levels of society, you don't have an accurate picture of what patterns of poverty are like. The UK data, interestingly, looks a bit different. In the UK, it looks as though people get stuck more in conditions of poverty than they do in Germany, although still far more people move out of poverty than we thought was true before. No one really realized that there was so much movement in and out of poverty before in Western countries. This is probably a generic feature of Western countries. It has a lot of interesting implications because, you see, when people study poor communities, they just tend to assume that people were stuck there. And they're just there, and you study them in poverty. But really, you want to study people who move out of poverty. And for policies against poverty, one of the things you need to do is to stop people dropping back in again. So you don't just want to concentrate on the poor, you want to concentrate on the next level up. And you want to protect people so that they have the chance to escape from poverty, but also the chance to stay out of poverty. This, in some respects, has revolutionized social policy in Western countries over the past 10 or so years, quite rightly. Second aspect of patterns of inequality and changing patterns of inequality brings you to the famous social exclusion. I say famous because most left of center parties now talk a lot about social exclusion, and a lot of their leftist critics say, why are you doing this? This is just a kind of anodyne or neutral way of not talking about inequality. But this is not the case. The idea of social exclusion was not introduced into contemporary politics directly through third wave political thinkers. It was introduced by sociologists, first of all, and it was introduced by the OECD. The reason why the notion of social exclusion is so important goes back partly to the changes in class structure that I mentioned before. A generation ago, the main problem, or one of the main problems of equality, was integrating a blue-collar, manual working class into the rest of society. That was the classical socialist project, if you like. That's what socialism was all, in a way, about. Integrating a working class, a big working class, into full social economic citizenship. Now you only have about 16% of the population working in those traditional blue-collar occupations. The working class has shrunk radically in all Western countries, no matter how you define it. Doesn't matter whether you include people working in unskilled work on petrol stations or whatever, the proportion of people in these occupations has shrunk. What this means is that you have in all Western countries a new structure of inequality at the bottom, where you have something like 10 to 15% of the population who are often fairly radically excluded from mainstream participation. The reason for using a notion of social exclusion is that it directs attention to the connection between inequality, cultural exclusion, physical exclusion, a whole range of circumstances that stop people in the poorest sectors of society being able to play a role in the wider economic and social system. That 10%, you have to try and get back into the mainstream. Social exclusion often also involves physical exclusion. And here, in politics today, in social policy today, we have to deal with, I hope you feel better later, we have to deal with the consequences, the kind of perverse consequences of the earlier forms of the welfare state. People often think the welfare state is the solution to poverty, but at least some innovations in the welfare state have actually helped produce poverty. Most important of those are the attempts to construct public housing in European countries in the 50s and 60s, which have produced the most horrendous housing estates. Everybody knows about them. If you want to study them, again, one of the best people is here, connected in mysterious ways to John Hills, that's Ann Power. You should, that's an in-joke for anyone who knows that. It's called Estates on the Edge, kind of comparison of housing estates in Europe. In some of these housing estates, you have a whole sequence of factors which simply mean that you're unable, really, many people are unable to get into the wider society and are physically as well as socially excluded from it. Under the category of exclusion, however, you also have to include exclusion at the top. At least I think so, anyway. Which is sometimes called the flight of the elites. The Flight of the Elites. That was the title of a book by an American observer called Christopher Lash. I'm not sure if it's got a C in it or not, I can't remember, but anyway. The Flight of the Elites. That's when people do retreat to their own affluent ghettos of private health, gated communities, and so forth. Social policy must deal with that form of exclusion too. Thirdly, accelerating slightly, what about the causes of inequality where inequality has increased? Key question here is, what is the relationship between inequality and globalization? Which is an issue I'll come back to in the lecture next time, because many of the people in the streets of Seattle were protesting about globalization because it's producing a world of winners and losers, a world of haves and have-nots. Well, so far as the industrial societies are concerned, we've now got some very, very good studies of the impact of globalization on inequality. If you mean by globalization, if you take a very narrow view of globalization as free trade, the expansion of equality to produce more open competitive economies, the results of recent research show that this has only had a marginal impact on increasing inequalities. the best study we have, the author of whose name I've temporarily forgotten, so I can't put it down for you, very big study in the United States, showed that globalization in this sense anyway only accounts for less than 5% of the increasing economic inequalities over the period from 1970 to 1995. More important is technological change. Technological change, especially the advent of information technology, the new divisions that produces, the authors reckon that accounted for about 15% of the variance in terms of increasing inequality. But they concluded that the main source of increasing inequality in the United States was one that might surprise you. It goes back to the very first lecture I gave in this course when I talked about changes in people's lifestyles. The core influence over increasing inequality in the United States, changes in family patterns in a society which has inadequate welfare institutions, especially the growth of one-parent families, divorced women and children, figure among the biggest categories in the American new poor. And I think it's undeniable that the shift in family patterns when you don't have adequate welfare protection is one of the main mechanisms of increasing inequality, not just in the United States over that period, but in quite a number of EU countries too. Let's look quickly, move on to see what you can do about inequality in contemporary societies, because social policy is changing in relation to the attempt to target and attack the changing patterns and nature of inequalities in contemporary societies. The classic approach of the left has always been the first one. When you talk about redistribution through the taxation system, you're talking about a principle of justice which surely can't be disputed or can't be disputed by many, which is take from the rich to give to the poor. A kind of Robin Hood principle of redistribution has always been a key aspect of political programs on the left. And the income tax system, progressive income tax, has always been one of the main means whereby a kind of direct appropriation from more affluent groups to give to poorer groups is structured into the programs of left to center parties. Should we sustain such a principle? I think you have to say yes. Progressive taxation must remain a core part of economic redistribution in relation to the attack on inequality. However, you have to recognize there are reasons why nearly all Western countries have reduced the level of their progressiveness of income tax, have reduced income tax on the more affluent groups. Reasons are twofold. One is we know from a lot of studies that income tax influences innovation. Therefore, you can be penalizing effort and innovation if you put income tax too high. And you're really talking about middle class people more than the truly rich in these respects, because all progressive taxation comes mainly from the middle class, not from the very small number of people you might put as the very rich. Second, the more progressive your income tax system is, the more levels of tax evasion there are. So what you should be concerned with in a society is primarily the tax take, how much tax you actually get from a given system, which can be spent to alleviate poverty and inequality. And here the results, again, really interesting. Think of comparative studies in different countries in recent times, which show you that the most egalitarian societies are not those that have the most progressive income system, tax systems, by and large. The most egalitarian societies are those which generate a high tax take and spend that tax take on social transfers or on directly on anti-poverty programs and other welfare measures. There have been many cases of countries that have had progressive tax systems but high levels of inequality. Australia in the 1980s, for example, was one of those societies. So there is no clear link between progressive income taxation and equality. The core thing is to generate substantial tax take and spend it in an appropriate way. And that's essentially what Scandinavian countries, on the whole, for example, do. under this category of taxation, the left has also come to recognize that sometimes it's good to reduce taxes rather than increase them. Tax reductions can also produce more equality. The most effective way of doing this is through so-called working families tax credit, pioneered in the United States, now adopted here, being fiercely debated in France and Germany at the moment, whereby you give tax relief to poorer people who are in jobs. And you try to use tax relief both as a way of effectively giving more income to poorer people, but also providing motivation for them to be in jobs and therefore avoid the celebrated American problem of the working poor. You don't want too many working poor in a society which regards itself as egalitarian. Sorry, going to have to go through these other ones reasonably quickly. Second, a major shift in emphasis in all left of center parties is the need to invest in human capital, which takes concrete forms in the shape of welfare to work, in the shape of what are usually called active labour market programs. There's not much point having passive income transfers, in other words, transferring money to someone who is in the cycle of drug addiction or who can't read the instructions on a medicine bottle. You want to invest in people, especially in education, in poorer deprived areas, to allow people to use their own skills and capacities to find a decent place in the wider society. Passive income transfers sometimes have the effect of locking people out into further processes of exclusion rather than including them in. An emphasis on investment in human capital is closely tied to an emphasis upon the centrality of work. The reason for this is not at all what people normally or often say, you want a society which is somehow dominated by work. The reason is that you cannot have a decent society unless you have an employment ratio of something like at least 70%. You want a reasonable number of people in work so that you can pay for the social programs that people need. Everywhere they're the same, their health, their education, and to some extent pensions. Those are the things that people want. You don't want to be spending masses of taxation income on unemployment benefits when people can be in work protected by a decent minimum wage. All the countries in Europe which have secured this have had active labour market policies. A good example is Denmark. Denmark has an employment ratio of some 75-78%, introduced active labour market policies in the early 1990s. It sustained a decent mixture of egalitarianism with economic prosperity and growth and a high work ratio. Third, you must have targeted anti-poverty policies because of the new forms of social exclusion. That means, again, you don't just want generic income redistribution. You want to spend money on programs for poorer areas, especially where there is regional concentration of poverty and exclusion, in order to improve conditions of life for people in those areas. We know a lot about this now, partly from American experience. Again, if I mention authors, you check the work of Rosabeth Moskanter from the Harvard Business School. Moskanter. She studied programs of urban regeneration in poor, largely black American areas and American cities. She shows that these can be extremely successful. They normally involve money from government, therefore taxation revenue. They often involve, however, partnerships with business, but they crucially involve third sector or voluntary or local community groups. Unless you allow local community groups to mobilize and energize local communities, you don't break out of the cycle of social exclusion and poverty. That's the reason why you must have a shift towards such policies. Finally, we have to recognize that there are trade-offs, and these trade-offs we have to try to reach a clear assessment of. Basically, there are trade-offs between the proportion of people in work, the economic prosperity of a society, and the degree of egalitarianism of that society. If you consider the central European economies like France and Germany, they have highly regulated labour markets. They have, however, low employment ratios, and there tends to be a big divide between those who have jobs and those who haven't. Very hard if you haven't got a job to get into the inside. They produce insider-outsider labour forces, and that accentuates racism because it's often immigrants who find themselves excluded from the kind of core employment. A good society is therefore not like that, I think. That implies you must have a decent level of flexibility in labour markets because you want to allow outsiders and immigrants to get in, but you also want to protect people when they lose their jobs. So the classic new European approach to this, as it were, the new European social model, now called flexicurity. Flexicurity is the kind of thing which the Danes, the Dutch, to some extent the British, the Spanish, have pioneered. You want people to be able to change jobs, you want people to get in jobs, but you want to protect them. The best way to protect them is through investment in their own human capital. The best way to protect people is to have really good retraining schemes so that people don't become locked out of the labour market for too long. That's why you must have some extent a movement towards equality of opportunity. You must recognise the dynamic nature of modern economies, the importance of the fact there's a lot of movement in and out of poverty. The best kind of society I think we can come up at the moment is one where people are able to escape from, don't become locked into conditions of inequality. Our attempts to produce a more frozen, as it were, society of equality of opportunity tend to have rebounded. And a lot more in a longer lecture could be said about that. Just in conclusion, what do you do about the top? What do you do about the rich and the affluent? Should the left still have programs of redistribution relevant to such people? I think you have to say resoundingly yes, and it must involve the three things that I've written on a piece of paper. Taxation is crucial, but what's important in locking in elites into a pattern of equality is not so much actually level of income tax. What's important is level of tax evasion. Tax evasion is the crucial mechanism whereby especially richer elites lock themselves out of their wider responsibilities of citizenship. OECD have just mounted an international program against tax havens, which looks like having some real chance of success, which would make a real difference, I think, to putting leverage upon elites to accept their fiscal responsibilities. If you say a theme of the new politics is no rights without responsibilities, this doesn't just apply to poorer people who want to get a job, it must apply to richer people who must also accept the responsibilities they have for the wider society of which they're a part. You need to lock them in that way. You also need to lock them in, I think, by creating good public institutions. I think you could take it as a theorem. You cannot have a good society without good public institutions. This includes institutions of health, institutions of education, as well as orthodox welfare. The best way to lock more affluent people into the wider society is simply to make sure these institutions are good. You've only got to see what a massive contribution to inequality, the division between private and public education in this country has made, to see the importance of this. Of course, in a country which has such a divide, it's very hard to overcome it. But in societies which do have fairly universal welfare systems, like some of the Scandinavian countries, is a principle of citizenship, and it tends to lock the more affluent in. This suggests that you mustn't have too strongly targeted welfare policies. You need some to deal with social exclusion, but you shouldn't have too many. If you have too many, the more affluent middle class have no motivation to support public institutions because they're not gaining anything from them. Hence you get the flight of the elites which Lash described. Thirdly and finally, regulation of corporate power is clearly crucial to all this. And my feeling is that simply the future does not belong with the shareholding model of corporate capitalism. shareholding model, the American model, if you like, of capitalism seems to be on the ascendant, but I don't feel that can endure. I feel we must move to what Will Hutton calls stakeholder model of capitalism, in which you recognize that corporations, which now have enormous power nationally and globally, must make sure that those powers go along with responsibilities. And there are core ways in which governments can do this. Governments can do this through incentives. You can give corporations tax incentives, for example, for assuming citizenship responsibilities or for following sound ecological policies. But you must also be prepared nationally and internationally to police corporate power. A world which is run by corporations is not a world of decent economic and social citizenship. Are all these things possible? Well, I believe they are. I believe that contemporary left of center politics can make a significant dent in the world. I believe that we should still sustain these ideals and motivations. I believe a good deal, very strongly, that a good society is possible in this country, as you can see all around you. However, we have a long way to go before we achieve it. Thanks very much. Look forward to seeing you all, I hope, next week.